about goal setting strategies and some things that we brought up there. I'm not going to redo the whole lesson, but just some major points. One thing we said was that the heart has to be convicted if change is going to happen. If change is needed and change is desired, well, that's good, but the heart has to be there. The heart has to be in it. Everyone knows what it's like to be around someone whose heart just isn't in it when you're trying to get them to do something, right? Trying to play a softball game, a basketball game, or just a family gathering, or just trying to have a good time together with someone, and their heart just isn't in it. Well, that just sours everything, doesn't it? And you know that. So your heart has to be in that. Your personal resistance to spiritual growth leads to zero change, zero improvement. Doesn't matter how spiritual-minded you think you are otherwise. That resistance is going to stop everything. We also talked about, in essence, a works-for-me mentality, which by itself means nothing. It does nothing and saves no one by itself. It's just a self-inflicted delusion, thinking that you've got a system or a plan that may be different than every other Christian's, but yours is going to work. And no matter what God says about that, or that, you know, this God knows my heart, so therefore you're off limits to being critiqued or challenged or any such thing like that. That kind of mentality just is no place in moving forward, and especially in drawing near to God. And then we gave you a simple but doable four-step plan here. First of all, have a dream. I mean, dream big. I'm not saying every dream has to be huge, but as a collective of dreams there, make sure that your final dream, your biggest dream, is pretty big, okay? I think being with God is a big dream, but it's not just a dream by itself. We're not talking about a fantasy. We're talking about something that you're working toward. And then make a plan to work toward that. Make sure that it's God's plan that you're making there. And put that plan into action. Don't just talk about it or sing about it or get together and, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if, you know, about it. You have to put it into action, and then you have to see it through to the end. By the way, that last point there, not giving up or no turning back, that'll be our next lesson here next Sunday morning. But despite all the best intentions and all the best efforts, stumbling blocks are going to get in the way, and they have to be removed. Everyone knows this. I'm not talking about something you don't know. I'm talking about something that you're probably very well aware of. A stumbling block is really something that causes you to sin. We're not talking about something that just makes you angry or upset. I'm sure I make you angry, upset at times, but that's not the point. But if I cause you to sin, if I am the cause of your sin, well, then that makes me a stumbling block to you. So a stumbling block, or really to stumble itself, is to sin. A stumbling block in that context, then, is not something harmless or innocent. It's not just a mistake. And it wasn't put there by accident, either. It has been placed there, maybe not by you. It might have been placed there by someone that you trusted, or maybe in this day of, you know, social media, something that you saw on the internet or saw on Facebook, someone posted something, you accepted that as true. It's a false teaching that poses as truth, or it's just Satan himself working on your heart. Someone put it there, but here's the thing, you allowed it. Okay? So if there's a stumbling block in your life, yeah, someone else might have put it there or you put it there, but regardless, you allowed that thing. And until now, until this point in time, you have kept it there. And now what we're asking is reevaluate your life and look for those stumbling blocks that are there in your path and get rid of those things. Identify what they are, confront those things, and then remove them. That's really what this whole lesson is about here. Okay, so in effect, this stumbling block is whatever stands in the way of you drawing near to God. That's been our objective all along through this whole series. What do I need to do? I need to get closer to God. I need to be more in conformity with Christ. What is stopping me from doing that? Any resistance of grace is a stumbling block. Any obstacle to grace that you allow to be there in your life is a stumbling block. Think about what Jesus says about stumbling blocks here in Matthew 5, verse 29 and 30. He says, if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. It is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. So just think about what he's saying here about the effect of stumbling blocks. They can cause you to lose everything. And so he's saying also that stumbling blocks, some of them might be easier to remove than others. Some of them might just be a simple decision. Okay, I recognize this thing that needs to go, done. All right, but others are going to be like cutting off your right hand as far as the difficulty involved. Some of these stumbling blocks, let's just admit it, some of these stumbling blocks that we have in our lives might be people or things or relationships, and by the way, relationships don't have to be with people. It can be with food or activities or anything else. It might be something so near and dear to you that you feel agonized to have to remove that thing from your life. Even though it's causing you to sin, even though it's keeping you from God, still it is a painful process. You're just going to have to accept that. I'm not saying it's easy because you accept it, but you're going to have to accept that. For some, it is excruciatingly hard. That's an interesting word, excruciating, meaning from the cross. Literally what that word means. It is a cross-bearing thing. So regardless of what that is, I'm not here to tell you all of what the stumbling block could be, but I am saying that you cannot move forward if stumbling blocks are in your way. Much good can be ruined by one stubborn, well-placed stumbling block. Much good can be ruined by that. So we're going to cite, as an analogy here, my first lesson on this series. Dr. Phil McGraw wrote a book called The Ultimate Weight Solution, and I'm going to use kind of weight loss or, you know, weight management as an analogy to what we're talking about because it has such a great fit there, okay? And a lot of people can relate to that, too. Most people, at some time or another, probably have tried to lose weight, and I've done that myself, so I've gone through that process. I know the difficulties that are involved. I know the talking yourself out of it that goes along with that, and I know all these other things that are going to come up here. Dr. Phil says that one's body weight is something that has to be managed. It's not something that is going to be cured. It's not like you have a cold. I mean, if you're overweight, it's not like you take some medicine and it just goes away. It's something that has to be managed over time. And that's why, as I've said before, dieting is a fad, is a temporary thing. Weight management is a lifestyle. That's really what you want, is weight management. Just like you want spiritual management or life management. We're not talking about faddish things, you know, like where you get an epiphany and you want to be all spiritual for a while. Well, that's fine, I guess, but it's not going to last. It's like a big flame, you know, and then it just dies off and then you've got nothing. You need to manage that. You've got a problem that has to be managed. You can't cure yourself of ever sinning again or of ever being distracted again or of ever being bored again. You just can't cure yourself of that. You're always going to have the potential, the desire, the craving for sin and laziness. How you handle that, however, that determines how successful you'll be. And so there's some danger zones, as Dr. Phil refers to them in his book, and I'm going to talk about those, first of all, in his words, and then we'll talk about that in light of our spiritual context here. The first thing he talks about, a danger zone, is disappointment. This is when you want to talk yourself out of something good that you started. And the reason why you want to do that is because you're not reaching your goals as fast or easily or as effectively as you first thought they were going to be reached or as you wanted them to. And this, most likely you will experience this in one form or another. Guarantee you, if you make a goal, especially about losing weight, something that's so impacting your regular everyday lifestyle, that is going to come up. You're going to feel disappointment. And disappointment can lead to discouragement. And discouragement can lead to giving up. And giving up can lead to just kind of cynicism, where you just lose faith in everything and everyone. So you're going to have to accept that up front and prepare to deal with that up front. It's not that you don't believe at all. It's just that there's pockets of disbelief, okay? There's areas in which you don't believe, and that needs to be addressed there, is really what I'm saying. That's where I bring in Mark chapter 9, verse 22 through 24, where Jesus confronts this man whose son is demon-possessed, and then the man says something remarkable. He says, if you can do anything, help us. And Jesus says, I wonder if I can do anything. You know, what does Jesus say? If you can. I mean, it just almost exasperated. If you can, and then follows up with, all things are possible to him who believes. And the man says something very profound that I know I identify with, and you probably can too. I do believe. Help my unbelief. And so there it is. It's not that we don't believe. We're talking about moving forward and drawing near to God and good commitments, good resolutions. It's not that we don't believe in that. It's just that we have these pockets of unbelief. We have these pockets of profound disappointment in ourselves, or maybe this discouragement because of something else or someone else, or maybe things aren't just happening as fast as we want or in the way that we want. It just, we thought it was going to be easy. We thought a couple weeks of Bible study, no problem. And we a couple weeks of Bible study later and we still have a problem. I think we've all been through that. Maybe you're going through that right now. And this is something that you're going to have to go to God with and seek his help in overcoming that, just like this man did. He didn't say, forget it, I've got this on my own, let me take care of my son. He's going to Jesus, the Son of God, and saying, I need help, I need your help. No one else can do this, apparently, but you can. And that forces us to rely upon God even more for our spiritual goals. Remember, your objective is deeper fellowship with God. You call upon him to help you and allow his work to be done in you, in his way, and on his time schedule. Don't try to rush God or rewrite the schedule for him. I know that is our natural human inclination to do that, and it never has worked before. It's not going to work for you. It will never work for anyone else. But if you let God have his way with you, then that will be a good thing. Dr. Phil goes on and talks about fixed fat beliefs. I know that sounds like a jarring statement there, but we're going to look about at this in regard to fixed failure beliefs. And that's really what this comes back to. He says that these are common, accepted, and devastating things that we believe to be true, but are really just lies masquerading as the truth. And the result of these, or I should say, the motivation for these is usually a poor self-image and, in our case, weak faith or uneducated faith, perhaps. For example, someone says, well, I'm just not worthy. Well, really, in a spiritual context, that's one of Satan's favorite whisperings in the ear, right? You're just not worthy. You're not worthy. You're not worthy. Over and over, we hear that from Satan, from maybe from Satan's followers in some way or another, just people telling us that, and that creates that poor self-image. Someone says, well, I just can't reach my goals, and that often prevents them from even making goals. Now here's someone who's defeated before he even starts. He's just looking ahead and go, oh, that's just too hard. It's going to take too long. I just can't do that. Well, that's that defeatist attitude. Or I'll never succeed because I can't change who I am. This is one of the most popular lies among Christians I know of. I just can't change who I am. Well, that's just how I am, right? And then we sit there and support it. Well, that's brother so-and-so. That's just how he is, right? And so here we are enabling the very idea that is a lie to begin with. Okay? There's a disbelief in God's power. Or this information you're talking about, this is all for thin people. Really? Weight management is all for thin people? I don't think they have a problem, okay? They're not the ones that need to manage. They're doing just fine, quite frankly. What you're really saying is, in a spiritual context, this information, this is for spiritually better people than me, you know, better temperament than I have. You don't understand my temperament. You don't understand, you know, what I've been through and all that other stuff that people come up with. And there's a person who abdicates responsibility. Or I feel too conspicuous of my weight to go out. Or in another way, I feel too conspicuous of my failures, my past failures and my faults to stand with fellow Christians. This is a self-inflicted inferiority complex. It assumes that no one else has any trouble at all and no one else has had your trouble at all. When in fact, even the Bible tells us that is just not true. Here's a person who's hypersensitive about a situation. Or someone who says, I don't deserve anything better than what I've got. Here's the self-appointed martyr, right? Since I'm not worthy because of my past sins and my past mistakes, I need to be punished by being denied success. Have you ever thought that way? I need to be punished by being denied success. If I were to succeed, well, that just wouldn't be fair because I don't deserve that. And so God is rightly holding me back from success, punishing me, and I feel the effects of that, and so we reason in our mind. There's that justification going on. I can't make myself look any nicer, someone who's overweight might say. Well, if you look at that in a spiritual context, really that if you can't make yourself any better, spiritually speaking, well, then indirectly that blames God because God is the one who gave us our looks, our temperaments, our personalities, and our opportunities. And really what you're saying indirectly is that, God, you dropped the ball. Now here I am suffering for it. So here's all kinds of fixed fat beliefs or fixed failure beliefs that people internalize and then replay over and over. Okay? Back when I first heard about stuff like this, I was told that, you know, it's like the tape recorder being, you know, played over and over. Well, we're way beyond tape recorders now, okay? We have CDs, we have streaming videos and everything else. Okay, whatever it is, but it's just still playing over and over, isn't it? It's still going over and over in one's mind, and they still keep coming back to this. This is what Dr. Phil calls limiting beliefs, or internal straitjackets, or what I will call psychological restrictions that impose artificial barriers on what you will do because it limits what you believe. So if your belief is very limited, then obviously what you're going to do is going to be very limited as well. That just makes sense, doesn't it? You're only going to go so far as what you can see. And so there's an idea there that there's a direct relationship between what you think and what you actually do. So show me someone who is not doing what we're talking about, who is not actually drawing near to God, and I'll show you someone who thinks that either doesn't need to, doesn't want to, doesn't know how to, or claims that anyway, and feels like he's got all these reasons and excuses as to why he can't or shouldn't. He's limited up here. That's why he's limited in his life. That's a very simple thing to understand, but it's profoundly life-changing if you can get a hold of that and start doing something about it. 1 John chapter 4, verse 6, John says, "We are from God. He who knows God listens to us. He who is not from God does not listen to us. By this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error." And that begs a question, who are you listening to in your life? Who are you listening to? We just watched a film Thursday night, and one of the things that came out of that was everyone is following someone else's rules. Everyone is following someone else's leadership. Everyone is following someone else's plan. Who are you following? Whose plan, whose leadership are you following? Because it's going to come down to someone, not yourself. And so you have to ask yourself, whose leadership are you going to follow there? Did the principles on your belief window, that little screen, that filter through which you see everything, because you put all those principles on there, kind of filters out or filters the things that you see there, praises everything. Did that come from God or did that come from somewhere else? Did those principles on that belief window that you look at the world through and look at yourself through, even in the mirror, did that come from God? Did God put those principles on there or did someone else put them on there? And determines now how you see yourself. These are good questions to ask yourself and things that you need to come to terms with. For as a man thinks within himself, so he is. Proverbs 23, verse 7. If you believe that you cannot change, cannot improve, cannot draw near, or even cannot be saved, well, the fact is, you're right. You won't be. You won't do that. You won't have those things because you don't believe in that. And it's not God's fault, though. It's because you chose that. You chose to believe that. And just as much as you personally chose to believe that, you can unchoose that. And that's really what goal setting really comes down to. Resolution making comes down to unchoosing the bad things and choosing good things instead in its simplest form. It is true that we cannot all do the same things, achieve the same results, etc. It's true that we should never expect the five-talent quality of work from a one-talent man, so to speak. Okay, so there are some limitations of a human nature that are involved there, but we're not limiting one's faith, and we're not limiting one's belief here when we say that. It is not true that God will accept a defeatist attitude as an acceptable reason why we could not draw near. There's no good reason for that. That is just not acceptable. Another thing Dr. Phil gets into that people struggle with regard to weight management is this relaxed, casual, half-hearted effort. Imagine you want to lose 40 pounds and you start a weight management program, but then you only dabble in it every now and then, like every third day or so. Or one day you're all in. It's all, soups and water and whatever people are drinking and, skim milk. But the next day or the days following, it's going to be cupcakes and, cheeseburgers and whatever else, normal people eat. And so you've got this thing going on here where it's all, very austere, very strict and very, very disciplined, but then the next day you just lose it all. Or maybe in the morning you're all, yogurt and, granola, but by evening it's steak and potatoes, you know what I'm saying? And so it's just, all you're doing is playing with it. You're just playing with the system. Here's a good regiment, perhaps, and it will work if you were just to stick with it. But you don't. Everyone knows what I'm talking about, because I think we've all done that, all right? So we've all compromised the system. We've cheated, and we've done those things. It is common among Christians. They're provided excellent goals and proven strategies, biblical strategies, life-changing strategies, but some apply them with this hit-and-miss, now-and-then, hot-and-cold effort. And when you have no consistency, then that leads to poor results. And when you have poor results, then that leads to disappointment and discouragement. And then what do people do? Well, not surprisingly, you know what they do. They say, see, the plan doesn't work. I don't know how many times I've had people tell me that in so many words. Yeah, I prayed to God, but, right? And then fill in the blank, whatever it is. Or, you know, I read my Bible, but, or I did this, but. That's kind of like a but theology, right? It just doesn't work, okay? It's just, you can't do that. You can't just think that you're going to pray for a little bit and then read your Bible for a little bit and here and there, every now and then suddenly, miraculously, magically, everything's going to turn around. It just doesn't work that way. Prayer can't be something you do to fix a little problem. Prayer has to be a lifestyle. Studying has to be a lifestyle. Drawing near to God is a lifestyle. It's a management program. Not a diet. You have to approach it that way. It's not enough to merely know the secret of success. You have to employ all of your focus and your efforts toward pursuing that success. Is it hard? Of course it's hard. But you can't blame the plan when you or me is the problem. You just can't blame the plan then, when in fact it's us that is not allowing the plan to work. Luke chapter 13, verse 23 and 24, Jesus says some nice flowery words there for people. People of all generations will flock to verses like this, and especially when they're looking for a nice, fuzzy, soft, and comfortable religion. Someone came up to him and said, Lord, are there just a few who are being saved? And he said to them, of course, everyone's going to be saved. God loves everyone, so he's saving everyone, because God does that. That's what religion is all about. It's just giving everyone a false sense of security. So go out and do whatever you want to. Live your life however you want. Well, actually, he didn't say any of that. What he did say was, strive to enter through the narrow door, for many, I tell you, will seek to enter and will not be able. That's what he actually said. You say, why isn't Jesus so popular today in the world? Well, for statements like that, probably. So what is he saying? Well, just because people are seeking salvation or want salvation doesn't mean they're going to find salvation. And largely it's because they don't strive for it. They don't try hard enough. And you and I are not exempt from this. Excellent things demand our greatest effort, our greatest time. It's not something you could just play with here. And so, as you see on the screen, he's very clear. This is difficult, but it is doable. Peter says something similar. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 5 through 8. You know, therefore, applying with all diligence to your faith, add this and add that and add this other thing. It gives you seven different things to add to your faith. And then at the end of that, he says, if these qualities are yours and increasing, they render you neither useless nor unfruitful in entrance to the kingdom of God. What he's saying there is give your best effort as if your soul depends upon it, because most certainly it does. Your soul really does depend upon your best effort. And no one else is going to do that for you. And then people use crises to absolve themselves of their goals. I've done this. I know I've done this. I can think of specific examples where I've done this. Reasoned ourselves out of a situation that we know was the thing we should have done because the crisis came up. And the crisis can be something just as small as, oh, I don't know, daybreak, you know, or it could be just, you know, maybe an accident or something like that. It's similar to crossing your fingers behind your back. In other words, just think about this in regard to weight management. Well, I was doing really well this week until, you know, Thursday I got a flat tire and I missed a meal and I was just so hungry. I went to McDonald's and I got a Big Mac and a quarter pounder and an order of fries and some of those other things there, an apple pie, and then I got a milkshake. Okay, don't judge me. All right, so I had a bad day. I had this thing come up. This crisis is really what came up, and that forced me then. You know, we've all done that. Or on a more serious note, you commit to Bible reading on a regular basis. A lot of people in the new year do this, a lot of Christians, and it's a good thing. I'm going to read my Bible through this year on a regular basis. But then you have this particularly busy or stressful week, and you get a little bit Bible reading done, or then it maybe gets more stressful, and now you have no Bible reading done. And then you say to yourself, and this is where it all falls apart, right here. Well, now I've lost all momentum. My reading schedule is off track. I guess I'll just abandon it altogether. Maybe next year. What just happened? You just absolved yourself of the responsibility that you imposed upon yourself because of this little thing that came up, this little hiccup in your life, this little upset, and you let that hiccup, that upset, determine the future course of the entire year for you. How did you benefit from that? How did that thing help you, that decision to walk away from your commitment help you? It didn't, but you let it. I know that I've said that before. I've done the same thing, and that's what makes Satan smile. We should not want Satan to smile at us, okay? Because he's been throwing something in our paths, and finally he trips us up. That stumbling block got thrown in our path. He knew it. He tripped us up, and then we fell flat on our face, and instead of getting up, dusting ourselves off and saying, well, I'm going to try harder now, we just lay there in the wallowing in that dirt and the mire, and we say, well, I guess this wasn't meant to be. And thus, the crisis justifies getting back into the old, comfortable, familiar habits, the ruts. Some people look for those crises. Some people even cause them. So as to justify, well, this is why I couldn't finish what I started. For example, we've been talking, I know it's come up several times in the course of the last several months, you know, maybe coming to services and coming on time. There's some of you who, this is a struggle for you, and I understand that. But sometimes what we do is we create our own crisis. For example, when it comes to coming to services on time, you realize that about a 10 or 15 minute adjustment to your schedule might make all the difference in the world. But what do we do sometimes? Well, we stay up really late. Now we're really tired. And we slept through the alarm. And we got up late, so the family got up late. And because the family got up late, now everyone's running late. And now we got to eat breakfast, right? And you got to do this. Or maybe you found yourself during breakfast kind of scrolling through your Facebook for 30 minutes or something. And then you look at the clock, and go, oh, what happened? What happened? And next thing you know, you're late again. And then you say to yourself, well, since we're so late, I guess we'll just skip the class and we'll just come to services. Maybe you slept through all that too. Maybe just we're doing things that kept you even from that. But just you could see how it happens, right? All of this is preventable. Every bit of this is preventable. None of this had to happen, but those people in those scenarios let it happen. In fact, in some cases, they made it happen. Now the reasons for why they made it happen are I'm not going to get into right now, but the fact remains is the crisis didn't just slap them upside the head, they never saw it coming. The fact is they actually not only saw it coming, they created it themselves. You must be pre-programming your mind ahead of time. When you see those things happening, you should say to yourself, this is just what the preacher said would happen. This is just what Dr. Phil said would happen. This is just what I knew myself from my own experience would happen. And I need to deal with that. I need to have a plan to deal with that so I will not succumb to that temptation to abandon my commitment to God. Drawing near to God is too important for me to abandon this plan. So what we've been talking about there is internal stumbling blocks, things that are going on inside of you, things that you have control of inside of you, things that you're doing inside of your life that you have control of. Now let's change that and talk about external stumbling blocks. One thing you're going to experience, if you haven't already, is this. The more that you try to improve your life, spiritual or otherwise, the more resistance you're going to get from certain people in your life. Even those who are closest, even those who are most familiar, even those who claim to be the most concerned for you, you're going to get resistance from those people. And I am going to focus on people here in this external stumbling block. These people, if you allow them to be, these people will be stumbling blocks to you. They're not just making it difficult for you, they are causing you to sin if you listen to them. Think about what a stumbling block is. It's an occasion of sin. It's an occasion in which you are tripped up in order to sin. For example, if you are serious and committed about losing weight, you will automatically irritate and probably alienate some of those who are in your social circle who are overweight or who eat poorly or who are not serious and not committed. At least that's what they'll accuse you of. It'll all be your fault. Right? If you had just stayed there like the rest of them and eaten your McDonald's cheeseburgers and Big Macs and Whoppers and whatever else that you were consuming before with them, if you had just stayed on that course, everything would have been all right. They wouldn't have had anything to say. But now, oh, now you're going to go show us all up, and you're going to go try to lose weight, and you're going to do this, and you're going to do that, and you are the reason why we are upset. That's how it all comes down to. It's your fault. Here you are trying to better yourself, trying to maintain a better, healthy lifestyle. You're trying to manage your weight. You're trying to save yourself from falling dead of a heart attack at a very early age. You're trying to save yourself from having your arteries clogged up with all kinds of French fry fat. And you're doing all these things here that are right and good, and someone else has a problem with it. And when you listen to that someone else, I should have gone like this, if you know what I'm talking about. When you listen to someone else, then that becomes your problem. You are listening to the wrong people there. Dr. Phil says you need to sort out the saboteurs from the supporters, because some will want you to fail, or at least don't want you to succeed, while others will be encouraging and supporting your success. You need to reevaluate who you're surrounding yourself with, who your inner circle is. Because I just about guarantee that if you've been living a spiritually not so good life up until this time, that you've probably got people in your life who are very supportive of your spiritual inactivity. And those people need to be confronted in one way or another by you, either indirectly or when they come to you and start accusing you, you need to confront them and say, look, I'm not going to do this anymore. Sounds strange? Not at all, especially when you examine the kinds of saboteurs that we're talking about. You might recognize some of these people. Dr. Phil talks about the food pusher. And it could be, really, in this context, any kind of pusher, right? The food pusher may be your mother, it may be your spouse, it may be a close friend, it may be anyone who likes to cook or bake. It's always, you know, you come to their house and it's try this, or they're bringing you cookies all the time, and you know, you can never leave, you can leave your diet just this once, they'll tell you, and they're inviting you over for fattening meals and then pushing homemade desserts on you. How can you say no, right? You don't want to hurt their feelings. You don't want to hurt the relationship. And yet the fact is they're just not helping you meet your goal. Even worse, they're trying to keep you in an unhealthy state. They claim to care, but the fact is they're contributing to your demise. Think about that. I care about you so much. Here, have another cupcake, right? And what you're doing there is you're actually contributing. I mean, if I've got a weight problem, you're contributing to my demise. You're not helping me. If you really care about me, then give me something else, or don't give me anything at all. Give me a glass of water, right? Or a cup of coffee, or something like that. I'm just saying that, you know, it doesn't have to be that thing that is really ruining me. Dr. Phil says such people are often trying to seek approval from you in order to please themselves. Think about this. They're trying to give you something in order to get that gratification from you so that they feel good about themselves. Look at that. He's chowing down on that pecan pie I made for him. He's just happy, and that makes me happy because I made that thing, right? And so there's a kind of a backward self-approval thing going on there. But it's always at your expense. So you're the one who suffers if you give in, and you're the one who is demonized if you don't. So it's just kind of a no-win situation. And Dr. Phil says something rather important here. He says some people don't know how to love you in any other way other than with, in this case, food, or it might be some other thing or activity. They don't know how to love you in any other way except for this very dysfunctional thing that doesn't help you. And by refusing their food or whatever, they think you're saying that I don't want to be loved anymore. Or I don't want to love you anymore. They think that's what you're saying. But what you're really saying to them is I don't want to be loved like that anymore. So it's two different things. They're hearing, oh, you don't love me anymore. And what you're saying is, no, I love you. It's just that I can't be loved like that anymore, in that way. This is not helping me. and the misrepresents rather the entire situation. Dr. Phil says, and I quote, "Be kind when you can, but firm when you must. You are alone are responsible for what you put in your mouth. If the people in your life don't get this, then that's their problem, not yours." End quote. You're going to have to take a stand. If these people and what they're doing to you are stumbling blocks, if they're causing you to sin, you're going to have to take a stand. And if that's important for weight control, how much more so with spiritual goals? You cannot afford to cater to those people. I wonder how many souls have been lost who listened to their parents, who listened to family members, who listened to friends, who listened to their peers, and allowed those people to push all this stuff into their head, into their mind, into their life, and they never said no because, you know, I don't want to hurt their feelings. So you lose your soul because you don't want to hurt someone else's feelings. How does that work out? Dr. Phil would say, how's that working for you? It doesn't work. Remember the works for me mentality? Hey, works for me. No, actually it doesn't work. And when it doesn't work with God, it doesn't work, period. So we can't be accepting that. Colossians chapter 2, verse 18, Paul says, "Let no one keep defrauding you of your prize." And our prize here is our inheritance with God. Let no one defraud you of that. And that means that whatever means they're using or whatever manipulations, intentional or not, they're using, you have to address that and be ready for those things. Remember the prophet in 1 Kings chapter 13? The prophet who was told to go and prophesy and then come back another way without eating or drinking and staying at anyone's house. Some of you might remember that story. You can read it yourself. The whole chapter is about that prophet, unnamed prophet. And there's another prophet that lives in that town that was telling him. Now, here's his friend, his peer, a fellow prophet. He was saying, oh, well, God came to me and told me that it's okay if you come and eat and stay at my house. Well, this prophet, this first prophet, had been told by God what to do explicitly, what not to do explicitly. And then this other fellow prophet, thinking he's doing him good, comes and whispers something in his ear, and the other guy goes, huh, okay, I think I can do that. Well, what happened to him? Well, that first prophet, as he finally did make his way home, was killed by a lion on the way home. And that was God's judgment against him for not listening to him in the first place. I want you to think about what's going on right now. We are being told explicitly what to do and explicitly what not to do. And someone else is going to come up and whisper in our ear and say, oh, well, I'm from God. I'm a godly person. I'm a Christian-minded person. Here's what you should do instead. And if we listen to those people, what's going to happen to us? I'm not saying you're going to get killed by a lion on the way home, but I'm saying that you are going to face the consequences of those decisions. Take that very seriously there. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10 says that it doesn't say that you're going to stand there with your mother, your father, your sister, your children, or your friends. It doesn't say you're going to stand and everyone's going to sit there and vouch for you and claim, you know, well, this is what I did for them and this is what you did for me. No, no. You're going to stand there by yourself in the worst case scenario and with Jesus in the best case scenario. And that's all it's going to be. You're going to stand there in the judgment. It's not other people answering for you, but it's you. So do what is necessary to prepare for that. Dr. Phil does go on talking about the control freak, and this is someone who just doesn't want you to change because that threatens his or her relationship with you. So they're fearing this loss of control of the relationship, someone trying to impose upon you their expectations, and it's always, again, at your expense. Dr. Phil says, well, reassure them, say, yeah, things are changing, but your friendship, your love, your affection will not change. That is yours toward them. In the spiritual context, you may face someone who is more concerned with losing control than with you drawing near to God. They don't want you to change because they don't want the relationship to change. And so they don't care that you're trying to draw near to God or better yourself. They don't want the relationship to change. They would rather the relationship survive and your soul die. I mean, they won't say it in those words, but that's exactly the course that they're taking. And that's just not worth it. You may be forced to decide whether to continue with that person. We're told to sanctify Christ as Lord in our hearts there in 1 Peter 3, verse 15. The only person who ought to be controlling your life, if you belong to Christ, is Christ himself. And if someone else is trying to control your life, you need to seriously question who your Lord is, because you can't share your loyalty here. Can't have more than one master. Doesn't Jesus say something like that? You know, you can't serve two masters equally or at once. It just doesn't work. Then you got the green-eyed monster. Well, everyone knows what this is. Some friends or family members are just too unmotivated, too busy, too distracted to take care of their spiritual lives, their responsibilities, but they get jealous and resentful and envious when you decide to take care of yours. So it's not as though they don't want you to succeed, per se. It's not that they're not happy over your success, but the fact is, when you are successful, you simply magnify all of their problems. And they don't like that. You magnify their faults and their failures and their negligence. Peter says in 1 Peter 4, verse 4, that some people are surprised you don't run with them in the same excess of dissipation, which is a big word that means basically undisciplined living. And he says, and they malign you. Basically, they talk bad about you. They say things that may not be true, but they're trying to get you out of that lifestyle that you've chosen. You've decided to be a Christian. Oh, yeah, oh, you've been a Christian before. Well, no, I've decided to be a Christian, a Christ follower, and this is what I'm going to do. And they're like sitting there trying to stab you in the back or trying to assassinate your character or trying to tell you how much this isn't going to work and you're going to fail and all these other things. It's not that they don't believe in what you're doing so much as they don't want you to magnify the fact that they're not doing it. And you must not allow someone else's jealousy to rob you of your spiritual goals, especially your soul's well-being. All right, so there's some people that you don't need in your life to do what they're doing anyway. I'm not saying excise all these people out of your life as much as you need to curb what they're doing. And yes, sometimes some people have to go, and that's okay. Okay, there's nothing in the rule book that says that you, whatever friends you have now, you have to keep them until the end of your life. And especially if those friends, those so-called friends, are courting your spiritual disaster. But just because stumbling blocks do exist and you have to deal with them doesn't mean everyone is to be avoided. Dr. Phil identifies four different people that we'll quickly go through here that you do want in your life. First of all, there's the coach. And a coach is someone who knows how to help you, kind of like a personal trainer for weight management. He is a person or she is a person who provides personal positive influence, information, constructive criticism, counseling, all those things that you need. Often this person is a role model to you. I want to put a little thing in here that says, be selective in determining who your coach is going to be or not. Your best friend may not be your best choice to be your coach, because they may not see things the way they need to be seen, or they may not be experienced to be able to help you. You want someone with knowledge and experience. You don't want some amateur or someone who's struggling with the exact same problems that you have but has never overcome them. You want someone who has overcome them, that knows how to do this and knows how to do it rightly. That's who you want to choose for your coach. Do not distance yourself from such people because you're afraid of what they'll say. Listen to those people and listen to their advice. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 15 says there, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man is he who listens to counsel. Well, there it is. Listen to counsel. Excellent advice for all of us right there. Seek out those who are wiser than you in this area in which you wish to excel. Seek out those people who are wiser than you and listen to them. Let them coach you. Secondly, there is the umpire, who is one who provides refreshing candor and honesty. You trust this person. You're willing to confide in this person as much as is needed anyway. They are a good listener. They are a good observer. They are alert. They are interested. They are responsive. But I have to warn you, they may be blunt and unpopular in their decisions, just like real umpires, okay, who have to make calls that go against the team or even the whole stadium, you know, of what they want there, but they make the call because it's right. They're not concerned with popularity. They're concerned with getting it right. And that's what you want to be concerned with, not popularity, not just winning all your family and friends and keeping all your family and friends. That is not the point. If that is the point, well, then you shouldn't have become a Christian, okay? But now that you're a Christian, the point is to do what's right and get an umpire that's going to hold you to that. Or there is the teammate, someone who shares your sense of purpose and your spiritual convictions. When you're going to the gym, it's always best to take someone with you. Why? They call it the buddy system. It's hard to work out by yourself. I've done it. I've tried it. It's always easier to go with someone who is working out with you. Same with weight management program. It's hard to get on a weight management program by yourself. It's a lot easier to do it with someone else who wants the same thing that you want. And so look for those Christian kindred spirits, those people who want what you want, who share your passion, who share your dream, who want you to succeed, and they want to succeed too. There's a teammate for you. And then finally, there is the cheerleader. No, not the one you thought there, but but this may not be as close as a teammate there, but offers honest and meaningful encouragement. Someone who is supporting you without constantly judging you. He doesn't lie to you to make you feel better. She doesn't lie to you to kind of assuage the situation there. They believe in your goals and they believe in you. Quite frankly, we need a little bit of rah-rah support now and then, don't we? We need a great cloud of witnesses, figuratively speaking, to surround us and applaud us when we've done well and not to just turn our heads and walk away from us when we fail. We need these people. So there's four people you need in your life: a coach, an umpire, a teammate, a cheerleader. Now we're talking about human on the human level. We're not trying to say these people do instead of Christ. We're saying you need Christ, number one, but these other people are all going to be working for the same thing. And you need them in your life. What we're talking about here is stumbling blocks. Stumbling blocks is a serious problem. Jesus says that people lose their soul over stumbling blocks, and they need to be identified, and they need to be removed. So let's recap what we've talked about in this lesson, just very briefly. First of all, you may have been your own worst enemy against your own spiritual success up until now, but it does not have to be that way from this point forward. If you choose to keep stumbling blocks in your life rather than cut them out and cast them from you, you're not a disciple of Jesus Christ like you claimed. Because a true disciple of Jesus Christ would not allow a stumbling block to remain there if he knew what it was. He would do everything in his power to get rid of that. He would appeal to God himself to help him with that. Some people in your life do not want you to succeed and will, consciously or not, do whatever they can to make things difficult for you. They care more about themselves than they care about your soul. They may not say it. They may not even see it. They may be oblivious to that, but it doesn't change the fact. These people and their actions, if you let them be, are stumbling blocks to you if they are keeping you from your God. Other people do want you to succeed, and they will bend over backward to assist you as long as you prove yourself to be serious and committed to your resolutions. If not, they will know it, and they're not going to waste their time with you any longer. Once they see it, once they see that you're not sincere, you're a fraud, you're fake, you're just all words, all talk, they're going to turn away from you and find someone else who they can help because they're that kind of people. They want to help people, not enable irresponsibility. This whole series is not intended to outline your spiritual resolutions, but rather just to tell you some of these things. First of all, you need spiritual resolutions. You need those things, and that spiritual resolution in the big picture is to draw near to God. And you need to learn how to achieve these things, and you need to learn about what it is that's going to stand in your way. What you do with all this information, that's up to you. No one's forcing your decision. No one's twisting your arm. No one's keeping score. But if you truly want to be with God, if you really want to be with God, then you have to resolve to draw near to God. There is no other way. We're not saying, it'd be really good if you could do this. Rather, we're saying what Peter says: you're not going to enter the kingdom of God unless you do this, unless you do it. God does not want you to fail, nor does he expect you to fail. He's given you every reason to succeed. Jesus Christ has not just made eternal life with God something you can dream about, but that is unreal and hopeless, but he's made it real and possible and doable. I don't know what else I could say at this point, except to say that this is something that you can do. It's something you ought to be doing, something you should be doing as soon as possible. The first things first, though. You can't do any of this. You can't be drawing near to God if you're not even in Christ. You have to be in Christ to do any of this. And being in Christ means being a Christian. Being a Christian means being in the body of all the redeemed of all time, and that means in Christ's church. And the only entrance into that is through baptism. We can go through all the scriptures if you need to. We can talk about that later. But the point is, you've got to be baptized into Christ in order to be in Christ and then to draw near to God through Christ. That's our lesson this morning. We'll finish it up next week with our last lesson on this series. If anyone needs to respond by coming forward, this would be your time to do so. Please come forward if you need to.